محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S.-backed Saudi-led war in Yemen continues to take its toll on the civilian population, especially children. According to the U.N., more than 11,000 children are known to have been killed or maimed, a toll likely to be far higher, while hundreds of thousands more remain at risk of death from preventable diseases or starvation. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how can the U.S. and EU support and back the Saudi regime when civilian lives, especially children, are being lost, and why the international community as a whole has fallen way short when it comes to Yemen. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Elijah Magnier joins us. He's a journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Farah Hughes, journalist, activist, and director at Palestine Aid, joins us from Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Farah Hughes, I'll start with you, and I want to zoom in on the position that you have in your title as an activist when you hear about the alarming stats, which I'm just going to round it up. I don't want to just keep hashing it out throughout the program. 11,000 children to have been killed or maimed, thousands have lost their lives, obviously hundreds of thousands remain at risk of death from the keyword preventable diseases or starvation, and then you have about 2.2 million Yemeni children acutely malnourished, one quarter of them under the age of five. And then most at risk of cholera, measles, and other vaccines. Your reaction to that?
I think they're very sobering statistics, and I think that the very important thing about statistics are, apart from the fact that they're factually accurate, although as you've stated, they could be a lot higher than has been recorded, I think every statistic represents a person, be it a child, a father, a brother, a sister, a mother, an auntie, or an uncle. Every preventable death, every death that has occurred due to Saudi Arabia's disgraceful kind of attack and punitive punishment of the people of Yemen. Behind every statistic, there is a human being, there is a wider family, there is a community and wider society. When you look at how many people have died, how many people are facing hunger, the absolute kind of travesty and tragedy that is existing and how people are forced to live every day. It's all preventable. It could all stop tomorrow. It's not just a matter of political will. It's a matter of humanitarian desire by the people involved to end this kind of horror show that's being inflicted upon the people of Yemen. I mean, it just struck me earlier before you went on air. I was thinking, you know, is this all down to one man? Is this one person's ego? Is this Mohammed bin Salman? Is it all down to him? I know he's backed by America. I know he's backed by Britain. I know he's backed by Israel. I know he has his own kind of twisted political ideology that has him involved in the war on Yemen. But I do wonder if he was not in charge. I also believe possibly before 2015. I don't know if he was the minister for the army and stuff in Riyadh. But it seems to be since he took over the reins of power in Riyadh that this has all come about. So
sure.
It's tragic and it's sad and it's eminently preventable.
Well, the key word, as you mentioned or repeated my stance on this, preventable is what is the focus in my next question to you, Elijah Magnier, also, because Ansarullah has come out and said that, they have been looted by over $13 billion worth of their oil wealth over the past 5 years. This is money, obviously, that could have been spent in terms of the revenues they generated that's been stolen on their population, on their local population. And that's kind of sad. Why is it that this looting, which continues to this day, a lot of it to have been attributed to the UAE, still continues, even though, of course, Ansarullah is trying to find a way to stop that?
Well, actually, no war has been more deadly over the last 8 years than the Saudi-US Western war on Yemen. The theft of the Yemeni oil falls into the same policy of the West to deprive the Yemeni from their natural resources, as they are doing with Syria, and is to starve further the Yemeni population, because it is not enough to see more than half of the population starving. 23 million in Yemen are suffering because of the war, and the double standard of the West is so obvious that we have people lecturing us about what's happening in Ukraine and what Russia is doing in Ukraine and how we need to feel in support of the Ukrainian, and the war has been going on only for the last 8-10 months. So we have 8 years almost of massacring, mainly children under the age of 5, 500,000, as you rightly said, and 2.2 million children malnourished. All that is really going just invisible to mainstream media, to the Saudi, to the Emiratis, to the Americans, to the Europeans, who pretend to be supportive of the humanitarian cause of the world. So all that is a pure double standard on how we deal with the poorest country in the Middle East. But when it comes to a country in the European continent, so we change all our values suddenly. And stealing the revenue of Yemen, preventing Sana'a from having its share, from having the salary of the employers, from allowing the airport to function properly, from allowing the harbor to receive all the goods that are needed in Yemen, this is a really genocide that's happening under our eyes, and we feel completely numbed about it, because this is what the West wants us to avoid and not to look at for the last 8 years.
Sure. Well, when we want to take a look at a response to this, Frahi, is in terms of trying to figure out how we can help, we cumulatively, as in the notion of us, the world altogether, we need to, because we keep asking, what about the international community? Why is it not doing enough? This so-called international community has to go through, if it wants to do something on a large scale, through organizations like the UN. Well, the UN doesn't even have enough money to fulfill its budget. The news came out last week, and we've heard that scenario before. Other organizations cannot live up to the monumental task of trying to provide for all these people. But there is one source that can do that. That source, based on the revenues for one day, generates $700 million in profits every single day. And that's Saudi Arabia's Aramco. Just for one day, and that money, that could help solve the problem. I don't know to what degree, but to a large degree, of what's happening in Yemen. What does that say when Saudi Arabia doesn't want to give up profits for one day to help that situation?
It maybe proves that money is more important than human life. that the value they place on money is more important than the value that they the value that they place on human life. I mean, when we witness kind of what's happening in Yemen, again, you know, I see parallels with Gaza. Gaza's under siege by air, by land, and by sea by the Zionist entity. It figures out how many calories the people can get by on per day. It prevents children moving from Gaza to the West Bank or indeed Israel in order to receive medical treatment. It bans all kinds of building supplies, medical supplies, even food supplies, fuel supplies from reaching Gaza. So we have exactly the same situation in Yemen. And if you look at what's happening in Gaza, and you look at how the Zionist entity is stealing the resources of the Palestinian people in the gas and oil fields that are off the Gazan coast, we witness exactly the same thing in Yemen. A lot of wars are about political control. They are also about land acquisition and expansionism for the countries involved. But the bottom line has always been money, and it is about money. And so long as the UAE and Saudi Arabia and others continue to steal the oil from the ports in Yemen, then I think this will continue because there is simply money to be made. If you talk about the hypocrisy of the West, we could talk about that forever and a day. I remember in, I think it was 1985, don't quote me in the year, when they did the big band aid concerts and they raised millions upon millions for the starving and the dying in Africa. I see no band aid concert for Yemen. I look at my Facebook feed, all I see are people cheering England leaving the World Cup. All I see is people cheering Morocco, possibly having a huge upset over France. Yemen is not even on my timeline. It's not even on my friends list of things that people are genuinely concerned about.
Sure.
Because there is international coverage, and the West is quite happy to allow millions of people to starve and die while it suits their political purposes to do so.
Indeed. Well, you know what? You mentioned a good point there, that it's not ranking. As our guest there said, Elijah Magnier, he was mentioning the fact that it's not ranking on top of the list, whether it's the news, whether it's celebrities maybe, or people who have something to say from politics and what have you. But it's, I want to have your elaboration on this money that's generated by Saudi Arabia, because it's quite a big figure, $700 million a day. You know, instead of funding their Saudi channel to encourage incitement and a revolution inside the Islamic Republic, of which they go after every second of the day, perhaps that money, not perhaps, but that money, I'm sure, if you agree, can help the starving people in Yemen and prevent some of the people dying there. The fact that it's not doing that, nor is it, I'm sure, being pressured by its allies to do that, like the U.S., what does that say about the regime there in Riyadh?
Well, the regime in Saudi Arabia, because it says, since Mohammed bin Salman said it overtly, that he wants to transport the battle in Iran itself. That was an obvious declaration that he is also behind all the rioters and all the attempts to change, the failed attempt to change the regime in Iran. And that's something that the U.S. support. And then they claim they have humanitarian day on the 10th of this month by saying, on the 10th of December, by saying that this is what we are celebrating. So all the money are good as long as they are invested in curbing the population and regimes who are not obedient to the U.S. Directives and policy. That is okay. They can invest as much money as they want. They can even direct all the resources of the media to concentrate on something false and promoting incorrect narrative just to topple the regime and create coup d'etat under the name of democratic colored revolution. For that, they can invest a lot of money. But to invest money in reconstructing Yemen, that is not possible. To invest money in buying weapons to Ukraine to continue watching how the Ukrainians are killed with the Russian, that is possible. So from one day to another, America is investing $50 million in one day sending to Ukraine. So far, $66 billion to build Ukraine, reconstruct Ukraine with arsenal and weapons. but not a penny invested in Yemen, and not even the same resources that come out of Yemen. And here I allude to the Yemeni oil that is stolen because the West is in need of oil, and they are taking the Yemeni and the Syrian oil. And this is should, in theory, create an outrage of all those who pretend to support the humanitarian cause around the globe. But because it is Yemen, because, as your guest rightly said, it's Palestine, because it is unrest in Iran, all there is a lot of investment to support the Israelis, to support the unrest in Iran, and support the terrorists that are crossing Iraq to do such an act, and inside Iran to do act of terrorism. So that for that, they have money to invest, but not in Yemen.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to expand a little bit about the regional security that involves Yemen with not a new actor, but a new energy resurfacing in a different way. We're going to get to that in a minute, and I'll explain what I mean by that. But Fra Hughes, the narrative is something that needs to also have some new definitions to it. Not new definitions, but to have the general public be informed of the way this narrative is being played out when it gets covered in the news, which is a false one. And that is the way, for example, the way that the U.S. sees Yemen and Western media in turn, where they say Yemen's internationally recognized governments. Well, this internationally recognized governments, I'm not too sure which international part of it is recognizing the government that they're talking about, because the one inside of Yemen, backed by millions of these Yemenis, is what we see when we do have coverage of that. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions, would pour out on the streets and support Abdelmalek al-Houthi or support the Ansarullah movements. I mean, there's obviously a huge disconnect there. Or when they talk about a Saudi-led military coalition, what coalition? The last time we checked, it's only Saudi Arabia and the UAE, unless you want to count the outside factors like the ones that provide military assistance like the U.S. or maybe some EU countries. So shouldn't the narrative also be something that should be covered here?
You see, the first, I mean, what is it to say the first casualty of war is truth? That's what we're talking about here. We are not hearing the truth. We are hearing the propaganda from the Western imperialist elite. A lot of the coverage in the West is obviously for Western audiences. If I turn on the UK television news, which I try my best not to, I will have my head and my emotions and everything twisted and turned upside down with the emotional, emotive propaganda that they use when it comes to Ukraine, when it comes to Palestine, and it comes to other conflicts throughout the world. So it's important that the real truth and the real narrative gets as wide an audience as possible. But when you have the censorship against Press TV, which we've recently seen with the Euro satellite channels, and I believe now RT, which has been banned in most of Europe and North America, Canada, and other countries, is now, I don't know, 20 or 30 countries within the old Soviet sphere of influence that have banned all the RT channels. So we're witnessing a huge propaganda war where if you're only told one side of any narrative, you have no counterbalance and you have no way to view the prism of the information that you're being given in its totality. So the propaganda war, when we had, we talk about the thousands and hundreds of thousands of dead innocent civilians in Yemen. 600,000 Iraqi children died, and Madeleine Albright said she thought that the price was worth it. 600,000 babies. Mm-hmm. And she said the price was worth it. It's not double standards, it's not hypocrisy. It is actually the kind of state, you use the word narrative, it's the state narrative being used by the capitalist elite in all these Western countries. We talk about Western society, we talk about Western media, we talk about mainstream media, we talk about, you know, the civilized West. It makes up less than 20% of the population of the world. It has an inordinate amount of money, finance, power, and influence. It's trying to hold on to all that by whatever means necessary. It's impoverishing, the West is impoverishing its own citizens in order to keep the rich and the elite in their positions of power and influence. And it has always robbed, stolen, and occupied, and raped the global South and it's continuing to do so. So nothing's changed from the Middle Ages, and the narrative that we are being told by the mainstream media in the West is a total fabrication and a lie.
Okay. Well, let me now get to what I spoke about Elijah Magnier, and that was a not-so-new face, but a country that perhaps has a new footing in the region, and this is based, and I'd like to get your reaction on, based on the visit and the lavish and extravagant, I should say, reception that Saudi Arabia had of the Chinese President Xi Jinping. Now, the summit of the Persian Gulf countries of the GCC came out with some points. One of them was that China supports Yemen's safeguarding sovereignty, independence, unity, and territorial integrity, and support parties in Yemen in settling issues through political means. Do you see any way that Xi Jinping can play a role, given the context of how it had all these multi-billion dollar deals with Saudi Arabia, and how it's going to be a provider, or it's going to be a buyer, not that it wasn't before, but now it's cemented that it's going to be probably the number one buyer of Saudi oil, amongst other business deals, that it couldn't play a role in settling this issue politically, since the positive part about this that I can see is that it doesn't involve the U.S.?
I think China is holding the stick in the middle. It is flirting with the Middle Eastern countries by supporting the unity and integrity of Yemen, also supporting a Palestinian state, and it supports the integrity of Syria. So all these slogan and big titles are part of the general policy that China is carrying out, just to say, I stay on the equal distance of all the countries in the Middle East, but also around the world as well. China is not made to be a confrontational country or a belligerent, and doesn't have intention to start a war or to even confront the Saudi or confront the U.S. Now, we have seen how the Saudis are taking advantage of China to send a message to the U.S. by signing a deal of $30 billion, just to say that I have other options. But it doesn't mean China is going to start working and be really active in support of the unity of Yemen and in support of a Palestinian state. The message that China is sending is China offering a model where all the countries in Asia need to be prosper and to develop, because it's important to have its plan to have all the harbor, the railway infrastructure built in every single country in the region, not only in Asia, but also to link Asia, Africa, and Europe, because China is offering a model that the U.S. is afraid of, because the U.S. went into Asia and created war, killed millions of people, and destroyed the economy of several countries, and the country that doesn't submit imposed sanctions like Iran, like Syria, like Lebanon, because they refused the U.S. policy. So China is not going to challenge the U.S. because China doesn't want to be under more sanctions than there are already 330 sanctions imposed on China. So it wants to keep the Americans away from its shore. It wants the Americans not to support Taiwan. And it doesn't want to interfere in Yemen by sending humanitarian support or reconstructing. It will not be allowed to go to Yemen to do so. China tried to do the same in Lebanon and was not allowed, and tried also in Syria and wasn't not allowed, and tried in Iraq, and it cost the resignation of the Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi, who was removed in the street by the pro-U.S. So I don't think China is going to carry out any particular role in supporting Yemen or in supporting Palestine or in challenging the U.S. hegemony in the Middle East, in Asia, or anywhere else. I think the Americans are very aggressive now because they are challenged in Russia. They are challenged in Europe. Their policy is not going to hold the ground. Here in Brussels, we have the European officials who disagree on everything domestic, and they don't know what to do because of the lack of energy. So the whole world is really unstable today.
I have 30 seconds to give to you only, Farah Hughes. Iran has called for the formation of an inclusive government, the Iranian foreign minister adding that we believe that it's necessary to form this government where all Yemeni parties participate. There has been a truce that was no longer in effect now for, I think, a couple months, even though the truce has still lasted. There haven't been major attacks happening on a continual basis. How can the momentum towards a political solution with the idea of Iran not being a bad one from what it sounds, to be enacted?
Well, all war ends in compromise, dialogue, and the cessation of the violence. And the only way, perhaps, for that to happen going forward is to allow a national coalition unity government to be formed where all players have a stake at the table on behalf of their constituents and hopefully be elected and have a mandate and go forward together as one unified country, tackling the ills that have befallen.
Sorry about that. We're just fresh out of time. Farah Hughes, journalist, activist, and director of the Palestine Aid Belfast. And Elijah Magnier, thank you for your contribution, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapwe, it's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وما أنا بطارد المؤمنين
And I am not one to drive away the believers.
إن أنا إلا نذير مبين
I am only a clear warner.
Dear listeners, as you were with us, we were discussing the 114th and 15th verses of Surah Al-Shu'ara. وَمَا أَنَا بِطَارِدِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ إِنْ أَنَا إِلَّا نَذِيرٌ مُبِينٌ I am not going to drive away the believers, and I am not but a plain warner. These are the answers Prophet Noah provides and gives the pagans when they try to implicitly say that if you want us, the wealthy, proud ones, to join you, if you want us to approach you, you must drive away these poor people. And of course, these poor people have had some wrongdoings and mischiefs in the past that you might not be aware of. But the Prophet said that I am not responsible for what they did in the past. The criterion the value of a person is that he is now from among the believers, and he must be, of course, as we know, the Holy Quran explains elsewhere, he must be trying to make up for his wrong actions in the past. And their reckoning is only on my Lord. إِنْ حِسَابُهُمْ إِلَّا عَلَىٰ رَبِّي لَوْ تَشْعُرُونَ. If you could perceive. This means you should try to perceive, you should try to understand, and our religion can be approached by wisdom and perceiving alone. Anyway, this prophet was found fault with this objection of attracting poor people, the people of lower class and lower social conditions. With dark opinion they had, they saw the scenery of those white garmented ones black, and they always demanded him to send them away to repel them somehow. They said that they disliked the Lord in the era of Prophet of Islam as well, and the prophets who had such servants and followers. But how beautifully the Holy Quran says to the Prophet of Islam sallallahu alaihi wasallam in chapter Kahf, the 28th verse, and keep yourself content with those who call unto their Lord morning and evening, seeking his pleasure, and let not your eyes turn away from them, desiring the adornment of the life of the world, and do not obey him whose heart we have made neglectful of our remembrance. And he follows his own low desires, and his affair has become all excess. على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا. We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qum.
The verse says, وَاصْبِرْ نَفْسَكَ مَعَ الَّذِينَ يَدْعُونَ رَبَّهُمْ بِالْغَدَاوَةِ وَالْعَشِيِّ يُرِيدُونَ وَجْهَهُ وَلَا تَعْدُ عَيْنَاكَ عَنْهُمْ تُرِيدُ زِينَةَ الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا وَلَا تُطِعْ مَنْ أَغْفَلْنَا قَلْبَهُ عَنْ ذِكْرِنَا وَاتَّبَعَ هَوَاهُ وَكَانَ أَمْرُهُ فُرُطًا. And his affair has become all excess. Even in our time, this objection is also about the leaders of the truth, saying that the majority of their adherents are formed by the oppressed and the miserable ones. It seems that this wealth has done something to them that they do not accept being with the others who are deprived of this wealth, who are from the poor class of the society. By this statement of theirs, they want to find fault, while unconsciously they praise them, and hereby they approve their essentiality. However, everybody must struggle decisively against the undue proposals and the expectations of the arrogant ones. Rejecting the faithful indigents is not permissible. وَمَا أَنَا بِطَارِدِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ The ones who have faith, the ones who are from among the believers, we're not allowed to reject them just because we want the others to join us. Because the criterion of value is faith, not the social and economical rank. And this is what this verse of the Holy Quran, what the practical life of the prophets and the Prophet of Islam sallallahu alaihi wasallam have taught us. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. Among the teachers and professors were, of course, some committed and considerate ones. However, they were too few and too restricted to take appropriate action, along with these and tens of other problems, including exile and isolation of the clerics and defaming many of them through malicious propaganda. It would have been impossible for their nation to revolt unitedly throughout the country. They were not unified in target with motto of Allahu Akbar and with dazzling and miraculous sacrifices to drive away all the internal and external powers and to take the reins of power into their own hands. Therefore, the Islamic revolution in Iran is totally different from all other revolutions. In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience from all over the world. You are listening to the program Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab Mousavi, and in this program, we try to talk about the precious and worthy sentences and words of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh about different modern and classic subjects. About the subject of knowledge and the knowledgeable, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh says that knowledge and performance, knowledge and commitment are the two wings that can soar together to the highest stage of progress and excellence. Well, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh in this speech is informing us about the secret of success, and that is the company of knowledge and performance. The company of these two concepts is so much important that Imam rahmatullah compares them to the wings of a bird which cannot operate without each other. This speech is aligned with Imam Ali alayhi salam's narration saying that فَمَنْ عَلِمَ عَمِلْ العلم مقرون بالعمل والعلم يهتف بالعمل فإن أجابه وإلا ارتحل عنه. The translation of this narration is that knowledge is accompanied by performance, and whoever is really knowledgeable takes action. Knowledge invites performance. In case it comes, they will both stay, and if not, soon the knowledge will leave. We can see that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, just like our infallible Imam, is trying to signify the great necessity of performance in accordance to knowledge, and knowledge accompanied by performance. We have seen that there are lots of scientists in the society who are not much useful for the society. You know, they are not only considered as fruitless, but also they are even harmful for the society. And that is because they just have gathered knowledge, and they can recite whatever they have learned without putting that into action. And definitely in case those scientists put what they know into action, a very different and ideal community and society would be the result. And that is, according to Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, a necessity for the society.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan has called on the Taliban to safeguard the basic rights of Afghans, especially those of women and girls. The mission said Taliban's edicts and orders, in many cases, have violated or impinged on the basic rights and freedoms of the population.
The United Nations in Afghanistan is urging the de facto authorities to stop restricting the basic rights of Afghans, especially those of women and girls, because those who govern have an immense responsibility as duty bearers to every woman, man, girl, and boy.
In reaction, the Taliban deputy spokesman said the so-called Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan has been committed to ensuring the rights of all Afghans. Bilal Karimi also dismissed the UN mission's stance as unreasonable.
We are committed to upholding human rights under the principles of Islamic law, but the statements published by foreigners can have two reasons. Either they are not aware of our culture and Islamic society, or they neglect our Afghan and Islamic values for political motivations. However, they literally don't care about human rights, but they have problems with Islam and implementation of Islamic orders. Such remarks by them are unjustifiable. Actually, our people did not fight invaders for decades to see Western patterns being practiced in their society.
Human rights activists say the Taliban need to be more flexible and supportive when it comes to the human rights of the Afghan people.
Of course, Afghans are Muslims and have their own culture, but the Taliban should not force people to practice religion according to their point of view. The Taliban are depriving the people of their very fundamental rights. Most of their orders on women are against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to which Afghanistan was a signatory.
Serious violations of the rights of women and girls by the Taliban, including the right to education, have added insult to injury caused by the U.S. sanctions on Afghanistan and their impact on the human rights situation in the country. The global community has so far refused to recognize the Taliban government in Afghanistan. Upholding human rights by the de facto administration is mentioned as one of the conditions for the recognition. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Like other parts of the Muslim world, Islam's faithful followers in Pakistan also observe the martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, the revered daughter of Prophet Muhammad. People from all walks of life attended morning ceremonies in different cities and towns across the country to pay tribute to Hazrat Fatima Zahra, who is also the wife of the first Shia Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib. The morning ceremonies included reciting verses from the Holy Quran, congregational prayers, and lectures on the life and sacrifices of the daughter of Islam's last prophet. While highlighting the valuable contributions of Islam's greatest lady, religious scholars said Fatima Zahra is one of the five holy ladies in the history of the world and has a very high position in Islam.
When we say that Fatima Zahra is a role model, we do not mean that this is the only limited to a few areas of her life. This discussion is endless and we can never stop discussing the greatness of her personality.
Fatima Zahra is a shining example not only for women but every Muslim. She cemented the guidance and teaching which Islam brought and showed us that they are possible to implement in our daily lives.
Some mourners also gave away food to the people in need to mark the occasion. They say that helping others in need is the lesson given to all Muslims by the Prophet Muhammad and his household.
We organize ceremonies every year to pay tribute to Hazrat Fatima Zahra. Distributing food is a custom of the Prophet's household, which is to be followed by their faithful followers.
Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon are among the other Muslim countries marking the martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Fatima Zahra.
While honoring her immense sacrifices and services in the path of Islam, participants in the ceremonies described Fatima Zahra as the best role model, not only for the Muslims, but for the followers of all religions. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
EU started out as a peace project. Some lawmakers say the bloc is becoming more authoritarian. A meeting of justice ministers on Friday heard at least €300 billion worth of Russian assets inside the EU have been frozen since March.
There are 1,359 individuals and companies on our sanctions list with assets and financial resources all over the EU. We cannot let anything slip through the net.
With even more sanctions on the way for Moscow, EU officials are now using torture analogies.
Every time that there is a need, we turn the screw further.
But at what price? The EU's energy sanctions targeting Russia are strangling the bloc's economy. Rents and mortgages are rising steadily. Young people in precarious jobs are at greatest risk.
Very, very bad, really bad. It's like everybody knows somebody that lose a job, that lose that is their people losing houses, families losing houses.
It's quite depressing for us to think that, for example, as for me, I'm studying a degree and I'm nearly certain that I'm not going to find a job when I'm done with it.
EU social affairs ministers met here in Brussels on Friday.
Many people, many households are facing difficult moments and we should leave nobody behind.
Charities say it's already too late for many and words need to be replaced by actions. At the same time, the EU is able to send billions of euro to the Ukrainian army and government. We do not hear anything about peace negotiations. Instead, EU leaders will meet here next Thursday to agree on more funding for Ukraine's army. On the same day, the European Central Bank will announce interest rates are to go up further. Critics say that priorities are all wrong. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Saturday, a string of anti-system parties labelled by the Italian media as the forces of dissent gathered in Rome to discuss the challenges being faced by Italy and the EU and future strategies. The meeting was attended by political groups including More Sovereign and Popular Italy, Reclaim Italy, an alternative, formations advocating for the protection of Italy's sovereign interests and for shielding a growing number of Italians who are paying a heavy toll to what they call a dictatorship of neoliberalism.
In short, we are under a dictatorship, a regime that has stripped us all of dignity, rights. We can't get decent jobs anymore. Our constitution has been vilified. Our youngest generations have been taught the wrong values.
Independent journalists and geopolitical analysts also attended the meeting. They slammed the EU for its vulnerability to corruption and NATO for its belligerent posture. They also argued that the energy crisis was purposely triggered to favor the energy giants and their shareholders.
NATO is primarily responsible for what's happening in Ukraine. A long-planned operation which has also involved the US Secret Services since the 2014 coup in Ukraine. We believe nations should reclaim their sovereignty and be free to strengthen ties with any country they want.
This affection for politics is running wild in Italy. The turnout for last September's general elections was about 64%, the lowest ever recorded, 9% down compared to the 2018 vote.
Our party was boycotted when we ran in the elections last September. The Italian media simply ignored us. Furthermore, about 4 out of 10 Italians did not vote, meaning that the current parliament only partially represents the will of the people.
Following the outcome of Italy's latest elections held in September, which saw a right-wing coalition led by Giorgia Meloni emerging as winners, all anti-system parties have remained out of the parliament. The once anti-establishment five-star movement managed to garner 18% of the votes, but its action in the parliament seemed to have lost both power and potential now that the party has moved towards more moderate stances. Max Civili, Rome.
In
Since the riots began in September, anti-Iran media has been depicting the situation as a violent crackdown on so-called peaceful protesters. For the past 2 months, they have been running a propaganda campaign to further pressure Iran under the pretext of violating human rights. But are these peaceful protesters? Iran's intelligence ministry has recently reported the confiscation of a huge cache of weapons and equipment used by terrorists. In fact, Iranian security forces have thwarted several arms smuggling operations and dismantled a number of operational cells affiliated with the terrorist organizations such as MKO. This comes as the illegal influx of weapons into the country is on the rise recently. The confiscated weapons were supposed to be transferred to Iran to be used in the recent riots. Last month, in an interview with the Persian service of the British state-funded broadcaster BBC, former White House National Security Advisor John Bolton said the, quote, Iranian opposition is now being armed with weapons. Bolton added that these arms are being smuggled into the country from the Iraq's Kurdistan region, praising the use of force against Iran's security forces. The recent foreign-backed riots in Iran have claimed hundreds of lives belonging to both security forces and ordinary people. In addition, by conducting acts of vandalism, violence, and insecurity, rioters have paved the way for separatist and terrorist groups to infiltrate the country and carry out brutal attacks against innocent people.
Smuggling huge amounts of weapons into Iran to be used in the recent foreign-backed unrest is merely aimed at undermining the country's security. But Iranian officials have time and again stated that Iran's security is a red line that no one is allowed to cross. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Lebanon has arrested 185 people suspected of working for the Israeli spy agency since October 2019, when the Arab country's ongoing economic crisis became apparent.
This is Israel's intelligence agency's invasion of the Lebanese virtual sovereignty. The Israelis took advantage of the economic crisis and the fact that the Lebanese are looking for job opportunities with U.S. dollars coming from abroad. And so they created fake companies through which they acquired thousands of resumes from Lebanese people. They were able to contact any one of those job hunters in the guise of foreign companies, while in reality they were Israeli recruiters.
Lebanese security sources have told AFP that the number has increased dramatically, from only 4 or 5 arrests per year.
One of the most notable examples of this was the busting of over 35 Lebanese and Palestinians that were gathering intelligence on Hezbollah and of the Palestinian factions in Lebanon for Israel. Israel, again, used a lot of fake companies and front groups to trap those kind of in a desperate economic situation into accepting these fake front opportunities.
Out of the 185 people arrested since 2019, 165 have been prosecuted and 25 convicted and sentenced. The economic collapse in Lebanon has taken its toll on the country in several ways, but it seems it's not the only reason for treason. Several collaborators admitted that they continued their communications with the Mossad out of sheer opposition to the resistance.
When we read the interrogation reports of those who were arrested, we understand that it was more than only giving intelligence. One of the suspects admits that he was asked to write articles aimed at sowing sedition amongst the Lebanese and inciting people against Hezbollah and resistance. They asked him, for example, to write articles which would give an impression that Hezbollah is linked to the Beirut port explosion in order to provoke hatred against the resistance movement.
Political analysts believe recruiting spies by the Israeli regime will continue since a military option is not on the table.
These kinds of more subtle forms of gaining influence in Lebanon and especially putting people into a very desperate economic state and taking advantage of that seems to both basically cut the losses on the military front that Israel and the U.S. Even know that it has unmatched against the resistance forces in the region.
Although Lebanon remains technically in a state of war with Israel, there has been no direct confrontation between the two sides since 2006. Nevertheless, Israel's espionage activities have never stopped. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The 18th International Muslim Forum has summed up celebrations of the 1,100th anniversary of the adoption of Islam by the Volga, Bulgaria. Many religious figures addressed the International Forum. Russian Mufti Sheikh Ravil Gaynuddin called for a just world order from the standpoint of the East. Chairman of the Turkish Department of Religious Affairs, Ali Erbaş, spoke about the connection between justice and security. Chief Justice of Palestine, Mahmoud Al-Habash, accused Israel and the United States of violating international law. The main two words, justice and a new world order, became the leitmotif of the plenary session.